Good morning, and welcome to Visualizing Pain and Addiction, an Augmented Reality Discussion. It's great to have you here in the room. This is also being streamlined not only in the United States, but worldwide. So Dr. Goepke and myself are really looking forward to an interactive and an interesting 60 minutes here. I'm Steve Stanis. I'm a medical director at Swedish Health System Pain Management and Services. I'm a physiatrist and pain management specialist. My colleague today is Kevin Goepke. Kevin is chair, Department of Family Medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine. So I'm really excited to have a primary care colleague with me, and I'll try to provide more of the pain management aspect as well as we go through the slides and answer questions, especially at the end through the iPad. We're really looking forward to a kind of robust discussion. And these are our disclosures. Our objectives for today are going to be to recognize the growing burden of the opioid epidemic, and remembering there's the opioid epidemic as a public health challenge, as well as under-treatment of pain and kind of poorly managed pain. So how do we do a better job at understanding both of those problems and better solutions for going forward? Also, we're going to really look at applying knowledge of acute and chronic pain pathways, and we're really excited about the augmented reality. Hopefully, many of you have never seen something like this before, and we think it's really powerful in trying to better understand the complexities of pain, whether it's in the periphery, the central aspects of pain, or at the brain itself. Upon a completion of this course, we're hopeful that you'll be able to incorporate best practice strategies to optimizing safe and competent prescribing and minimizing burden to patients and to the communities as well. So again, kind of an overview of pain, understanding the pain pathways, and where are some of the issues around opioid prescribing and safe use, and how do we put together a more comprehensive patient-centered approach for our patients. So with those kind of quick reviews of what we're going to do here during this session, I want to turn it over to Dr. Goepke, and then he and I will kind of go back and forth for the rest of the session.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome, everyone. Steve mentioned I'm a family physician like most or all of you. I'm mostly here to keep him in line so that the family physician voice is heard and people really understand where we're coming from here. When we look at opioid-related deaths and the overdose epidemic that we're seeing, we look back to 2017 and we really kind of hope that was the peak and that we're going to continue to see a decrease. But in 2017, more than 130 people died per day in the United States of opioid-related overdose deaths. When you take a look at this, you can see the red highlighted states as the highest areas in death rates per 100,000 people. But you know, you notice many of the states, including the state of Indiana, where I come from, you know, even though it's grayed out there, it just means that the data was not available at the time that this was put together. We know that Indiana was also struggling mightily, much like our neighbors in Ohio and Kentucky. When we take a look at this slide from the CDC, it really reflects what many of us have learned over the years, and that's the fact that when we started really looking at pain as a fifth vital sign and being encouraged, and many of us who were in our training during that time, it was you treat pain until there is no pain, as opposed to having many of these realistic expectations, and we'll talk about a lot of that today, having a multidisciplinary approach, getting away from the mentality of, okay, you have pain, here's a medicine to treat that pain. And as you look at the curves here, you really see that uptick when you look at the green line in that prescribing of the natural and semi-synthetic opioids, followed by the heroin uptick in about 2010. And at this point in time, and especially in 2017, about half of the overdose deaths in this country were from synthetic opioids other than methadone. So it really tells you how the tables have flipped there. Steve, do you have thoughts about this slide as well?
you've talked about those three kind of waves of the opioid overdose epidemic, and I think we're in a fourth wave of pharmacovigilance, where we're looking at a drug, in this case opioids, and trying to understand and assess where does it really fit in. And so we as clinicians, I think, deal with this on a daily basis. So kind of that fourth wave of trying to figure out what's a patient-centered approach, who's appropriate and who's not, and understand how can we teach providers how to do a better job of limiting the harms like we saw that happened right over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. And there's vigilance and then there's hypervigilance, and we're trying to find that right spot for right patients right now. So this next slide really highlights what many of us are well aware of, what we've been seeing for many years. But when we start to look at the patients who are using IV drugs, people who are abusing drugs in one way or another, it really changes their mentality. They start to put themselves at risk. They don't necessarily think logically and in a manner that they're really thinking about their own self-care. We know that there's a huge viral hepatitis increase. That rate has risen by 20%. Hepatitis C has gone up over 200% just in a six-year period. One out of every 10 new HIV patients is from using injectable drugs. We see many women who are pregnant and having children while hepatitis C infected. My wife actually runs a clinic and she cares for prenatal patients with opioid use disorder. So she sees that on a daily basis. And what we see is that the resources need to be made available. And that's really going to be one of the themes of this talk today, is thinking about the resources, thinking about the data that we have to this point, and then really employing that and figuring out how to best utilize it, whether you're at an academic medical center in a metropolitan area or if you're practicing in a rural or remote area of the country. The bottom part of this slide, I mentioned Indiana is by no means out and away from this. In 2015, it was really recognized formally that we had a major HIV outbreak in Scott County in southern Indiana. And the CDC helped with their data collection, helped show the state that some intervention needs to be made in this area. And really the root cause of the HIV outbreak and the hepatitis C co-infection that went along with that was IV drug abuse that was rampant in that community. When we look back, there have been several articles, and if you're interested, take a look. Basically, you just have to type in under Google Indiana County HIV outbreak, and you'll see lots of articles. And it sounds like the Indiana State Department of Health was getting some of these signals even before 2015, when the CDC really started providing more information, but it didn't rise to the level that there was action. So we need to figure out how to act on that information at a state level and really help our legislators understand why we need resources for that. So it won't be a surprise to all of you that there are a lot of patients that suffer from chronic pain. In fact, 20 million people suffer from high-impact chronic pain, or pain that really limits their ability to be functional and do the things they want and need to do many days out of the week, sometimes every day of the week. And that leads to kind of this cycle of people coming in to see all of us in primary care, talking about what interventions that we can provide, and ultimately getting to a point that people understand the pain, we have a firm diagnosis and understanding of what the pain is attributed to, and that really goes closely with the model that was developed with within the DOD and the VA on the biopsychosocial model of pain management. You know, as we all know, you can look back and many times identify a precipitating factor to a chronic pain, whether it's an injury, an accident, something along those lines. But there are so many other factors that play into people's perception of pain, how they react to pain, what happens in their world when pain becomes a factor. And as you know, as people start to lose function, as they start to lose dependence, when they have perceptions of limitation, it affects their mood, it affects their mental health. People have different approaches and thoughts about pain and how to go about treating it. Some of it is cultural, some of it's economic. I've had people from across the spectrum in my practice, from CEOs of big companies to people who are really medically underserved in my practice. And this is a problem that really it goes across society. It's not limited to one area. Steve, did you have some thoughts about this model?
The term high-impact chronic pain, new surveys are going to be coming out. That was the first time the government used that term to assess pain, and you'll start to see that more often. So we've actually started using that in our clinic, because those high-impact chronic pain patients are the patients that are probably going to be seeing you for medical care. And so we like to kind of start using that term, and I think it'll be important. And as the Healthy People 2030 and these other surveys that come out that we look at epidemiologically for pain, we'll start to see that. I think we'll get a better understanding of what's the true incidence of chronic pain, as well as addiction and those things. So high-impact chronic pain, I think, finally kind of captures what we see clinically. Yeah. So like Kevin said, I'm going to talk about, take a little deeper dive into understanding pain, because before we start talking about clinical kind of approaches and what we can do, we feel it's important to go back to understanding pain itself. And so this kind of shows the brain. You know, if we think about brain, and Kevin alluded to this, pain has this physical component, but also emotional and cognitive effects that go into that. So I always try to think about the five or six patients that you may see in a day, very different pain responses, very different psychosocial factors that they come with to your clinic before you start to see them. And so with the brain, we know the brain is complex, and the brain is not just processing pain, it's the output of pain, but that output doesn't always just measure what the input is, right? You can have minor injury. One person can have severe pain from that minor injury, whereas another person with the same type of tissue injury has severe pain. You know, why is that? Well, we know that the brain can modulate pain in different ways, whether it's previous trauma, genetic susceptibility. There's all sorts of other factors that go into how pain is perceived. And pain being that threat to the biologic integrity of the person, and then the suffering that the patient comes in with, that's the threat to the person, right? They're not the same person they used to be. Pain's impacting their life. Okay, so before we take a deeper dive, we wanted to break this down into three different areas. Chronic pain can prevent in very different ways. And this is going to be our chance to give you an introduction to this augmented reality. So we felt like we'd introduce you to Phil. And so Phil is if we think of pain is a warning signal to the body. We normally can conduct pain signals from the periphery. We usually do a good job of blocking those pain signals. If there's trauma, those things can change. So nociception is how we assess pain and how our body kind of processes pain. And then those tissue problems and tissue damage is going to impact how we perceive pain. So here's Phil. And Phil gets hit in the arm, and there's trauma to those nociceptors in the skin. That trauma in the skin is going to be picked up by receptors. Those receptors are going to take that signal. They're going to conduct it into electrical activity, which will be conducted to the spinal cord. At the spinal cord, it'll then be transmitted to the brain. The brain then will modulate that signal, and it can either increase or decrease that response. Depression, anxiety, all those different factors are going to impact how he perceives pain and how Phil responds to pain. The neurochemicals are going to be released. So in the periphery, substance P, glutamate, prostaglandins may be released. That's going to cause action potentials and sodium conduction along the nerves. And then at the spinal cord, calcium, all sorts of different chemical cascades are going to be either increased or decreased to modulate that process at the brain level. So we use different medications, whether it's the anti-inflammatory medicines to decrease the prostaglandins versus serotonin and norepinephrine types of medicines to inhibit pain signals versus at the brain, pregabalin, gabapentin, anticonvulsants to decrease calcium and other neurochemicals to inhibit signals. So those are just the pharmacologic approaches that we would be thinking about when we're dealing with Phil. So everyone say goodbye to Phil, okay? Mm-hmm. He's gonna say goodbye. And we're gonna now kind of, with that understanding of the complexities of pain signals, break down three different pain conditions. The first is neuropathic pain. With neuropathic pain, there's predominantly damage to the somatosensory system. So that would be something like postherpetic neuralgia, carpal tunnel syndrome, where you have damage to the median nerve. Here we have a disc herniation. The disc herniation is here, the vertebral bodies are here. This is the nerve root. The nerve root now is being compressed and chemicals are being released from the disc. Those chemicals are irritating the nerve, causing increased sodium conduction. That can cause a paresthesia, an abnormal sensation in the leg, or dysesthesia, or pain in the leg. Over time, even if the chemicals stop irritating the nerve, that persistent nerve damage can cause persistent signaling to the leg. So that's an example of neuropathic pain. And it's important to understand that the issues with the nerve here are also going to affect pain as it's perceived at the brain as well, not just the radiating leg symptoms that our patients complain about. So that's an example of neuropathic pain where there's damage somewhere along the somatosensory system. Okay. Now the next type is nociceptive pain. So with nociceptive pain, there's actually pain arising from threatened or potential damage to the soft tissues, and it's primarily activation of nociceptors. And those are commonly seen like osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, tendonitis, where there's damage or inflammation in the periphery, which causes changes. So we have an example here. And so this is a hand, so the MCP and the PCPs, or PDPs, the joints are going to be inflamed. That inflammation in the joint is going to cause changes with prostaglandins, mast cells, other chemicals are going to be released. That's going to cause conduction of pain signals to the spinal cord and to the brain. Over time, this input from these joint inflammation and inflammatory changes may actually cause persistent changes at the brain. So even though it's in the periphery, that ongoing feedback to the spinal cord in the brain may cause an amplification of pain. And many of these, even nociceptive types of conditions, can cause a centralization effect. But in this case, we're thinking about nociception in the periphery. We're going to target medications at the periphery, maybe strengthen the soft tissues around that to better support the joint. So that's an example of nociceptive pain. This last part is nociplastic pain. In the past, we thought of these as more central sensitization. In 2017, the international body used this term nociplastic. With nociplastic, there's altered nociception, but that nociception is in the case where there's actually no damage in the periphery. And we find that there's actually changes in the spinal cord and the brain. So conditions like fibromyalgia, where there's changes in pain processing, is actually gonna be seen in the periphery, and with lowering of threshold for pain. So fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, tension type headaches have this central component. So we thought we'd use an example here of irritable bowel syndrome. So we'll see if our gut comes. So here's the gut. So this has been described as a gut-brain disorder where there's stress can, with combination with psychological distress, inflammation can cause an increase in cascade of events. And we see changes with the microbiome. We see kind of hypersensitivity of the intestinal tissue. And that sensitization in the periphery and in the organs can cause changes at the brain. So nociplastic pain is now being called similar to what we've called in the past, kind of mixed pain or central sensitization type of pain. And again, we can see these similar changes with patients with fibromyalgia where there's sensitization in their brain, sensitization in the periphery, and how they perceive pain signals. Their threshold for pain is lowered. Okay, so we have neuropathic pain, nociceptive pain, and nociplastic pain. Okay, many times over time, patients, their physiologic response can be similar. Because nociceptive and neuropathic pain, that persistent pain signaling causes changes in the brain, just like they do with nociplastic pain, okay? And so a number of years ago now, we put together this in a paper just trying to give a better understanding of those different types of pain conditions: nociceptive pain, neuropathic pain, and nociplastic pain. And understanding with that, that many patients may have a combination of those, or they may have just purely nociceptive pain. But it's important to be thinking about this, because as we start thinking of medications, as well as non-pharmacologic interventions, we'll be targeting these underlying mechanisms.
Steve, we have a couple of questions related to the types of pain. It's probably a good time for us to take those now. One is there a pain modulator in the spinal cord? And another is, do the nerve cells increase sodium channel density in chronic pain disorders?
Well, I think the first question was about, is there a change at the spinal cord?
And, exactly. You know,
our spinal cord has innate systems in our brain to inhibit pain signals. And there are some pain conditions where our bodies lose that innate effect. And so it gets very complex. And with many chronic pain conditions, the spinal cord, especially with central sensitization, there can be a lowering of threshold for activation. And so with that pain signaling from the periphery, the spinal cord is actually increasing or facilitating pain signals. And that's, again, I think because it becomes such a challenge even when we use medications. Because I always think most of the medicines we use to decrease the pain, how many points do you think, Kevin?
One or two points.
So even though we can understand these mechanisms, to change that with medications is a challenge, because we have so many different levels where we see changes in the nervous system. It's not just one switch we're turning on and off. I think, what was the second question?
The second question is really, I think, related. Do the nerve cells increase sodium channel density in chronic pain disorders? And I believe the answer is not an increase in density, but there's an upregulation of those sodium channels, which sends more of the pain signal.
Yeah, so there's in the periphery, there's an increase in density even in those peripheral nociceptors of the different channels, and that's what causes the lowering of threshold for pain. So you think about inflammation in a joint, it hurts, or when you get sunburn, the touch becomes more painful because the threshold for firing is actually decreased. And there's genetic factors that happen after that that actually cause increase in sodium conduction. So the sodium conduction goes from the receptors in the periphery along the spinal cord to the brain. So there's definitely upregulation of sodium. And that's why many times we use anticonvulsants that help decrease sodium conduction. But again, that's just one factor in this really complex kind of network of changes.
Yeah, I think one more question on this topic before we move on is related to, how do you explain central sensitization to your patients? And it really goes back to that last type of pain that you described, the nociplastic type of pain, and how we've previously thought about peripheral sensitization and central sensitization.
Yeah, well, I think the question is, you know, how do we describe sensitization to patients? I like to use the analogy of sunburn. I explain, you have sunburn, you touch your skin, it's painful. For that short period of time, there's a lowering of threshold of the receptors in your body, and your pain is amplified. And I describe central sensitization as like your nervous system doesn't go back to normal. There's this amplification because the brain and the body is trying to protect itself. And so with central sensitization, it's kind of it's bad plasticity. Yeah, and so that bad plasticity is a chronic condition. So we need to use medications. We need to use relaxation training, psychologic interventions. You know, multiple interventions because of sensitization. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes they can understand sunburn or that kind of analogy.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this actually goes through the HHS pain. Interagency task force published in the last year a really comprehensive review. It looked at the gaps in the current treatment of conditions and then kind of put together recommendations and where we as a system, whether it's a national level, healthcare systems, payers, need to go to improve pain care. And it breaks it down into medications, restorative therapies, interventional procedures, behavioral health, as well as complementary and integrative. So moving away from this idea that you need to start with X and then step up to the next treatment, whereas this is being thought of, how do we look at all of these interventions together and understanding how we're going to fit a patient into those different types of treatment if we're really going to do patient-centered care.
Yeah, I think the key to this slide is that there's really no order to this necessarily, because many times patients come in and they're already somewhere along this path of treatment or intervention, and we kind of have to start over. And what I always try to start with my patients is, what is the root cause of this? And really take a few steps back. Is there even documentation and appropriate testing that's been done to establish what the cause of this pain, the type of pain? Is this a mixed pain picture? Or is this one of the distinctive types that that Steve mentioned?
Yeah, so the physical exam is really key. Is it, like it you is. Said, is it myofascial pain on top of joint pain, on top of not sleeping well? You know, how right. do we put that all together versus kind of getting lost in the whatever the original diagnosis was and not being comprehensive?
There's definitely an additive effect.
Right. So I'm going to turn this back over to Kevin, and he's going to kind of walk us through more on the clinical aspect and how we approach these patients.
Absolutely. So as you recall that earlier slide of looking at the biopsychosocial approach, this slide summarizes how we take that approach when we're seeing a patient. As I mentioned, the beauty of primary care is the relationship, that long-term management that we have of our patients. But when our patients are coming in with a new problem, or it's a new patient, whether it be a transfer or someone who is just finally turning 40 or 50 or just got married and their wife made them go to the doctor, which is what I see all the time, they come in and you have to start somewhere. So really taking that biopsychosocial approach through that history, really understanding all of those aspects that we mentioned earlier, and doing, as Steve mentioned, a great physical exam. There is really no substitute for a good physical exam. Having a practice that's really split between primary care and sports medicine, I see lots of patients coming in to see me for different problems that have had an MRI or some type of advanced imaging that their physician or they themselves are reacting to something that was found on that, but they've never really had a good physical exam. So it's really imperative to hone those skills. And if you can't do the physical exam, whether it be a musculoskeletal exam or a neurologic exam, you know, really engage another clinician that can help you with that so that this entire process is complete. Use diagnostic screening tools, and we'll talk about some of those tools, and really take a look at your prescription drug monitoring program for patients that you're considering prescribing controlled substances for. And then do that risk assessment in conjunction with your patient. This isn't something that we can or should do without that direct conversation with our patients. I don't know that I necessarily do it arm in arm with my patient like that, but there is a dialogue. And then you can get to the point that you can identify, is this a patient that's at low, medium, or high risk for abuse or complications thereof of any type of pain medication, whether it be an opioid or some other type of intervention.
And I think it's important, you know, that we always talk about risk stratifying patients related to opioids, low, medium, and high risk. Right. Those are the same risks you can look for patients developing chronic pain. You know, we have a lot of patients that aren't on opioids. You know, what's their risk for persistent pain? You know, so looking at depression and anxiety. So I think there's been a lot done around opioid risk stratification, and you can use that same thought process when you're just looking at your patient separate from opioids. Especially really taking a good social history and what's happening.
It's similar to the approach that we use with considering anticoagulation. Regulation for patients.
Right.
Yeah. So the United States Preventive Services Task Force, many if not all of us utilize these recommendations to provide evidence-based approach to a variety of conditions in our practice. Their statement within the last few months was that all adults be screened for illicit drug use, including non-medical use of prescription drugs, so not taking as prescribed, taking a friend or a family member's medications. And this next bullet really gets to part of what we're doing in Indiana. I oversee 47 primary care offices, and we've spent the last 3 years developing team-based care and a lean process improvement approach, just looking at trying to get to the point that our physicians, who we know are at high risk for burnout and are being asked to do more and more and more, can have a team around them that is able to really engage at top of license assistance, if you will, with taking care of a patient panel. We've organized in one way. That way is that every patient has a primary care physician, but advanced practice providers, PharmDs, behavioral health resources are embedded. We have dietitians embedded in some practices. And, you know, I think this really just speaks to that point that this doesn't all have to be on the physician back. We can really rely on our team in the office. And I realize that we're coming from a variety of backgrounds. Some people have in-office resources. Some people have in-community resources. Some people don't have a lot of those resources. But really thinking about that as we're going through the process. So one of the ways to implement this into the practice is by using an ESPERT, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. The screening, I think it can be something that is off-putting to patients if you're asking them, but the way you ask the question obviously plays a big role. If you're asking in an unassuming way, if you present it as, this is something I ask all of my patients because this is a big problem in our community, it really starts that conversation. A brief intervention, if you do identify people with risky behavior or potentially addiction problems. And the real challenge is the referral to treatment. As I mentioned, there are going to be resources. Sometimes they're not local. Sometimes they're going to involve a patient traveling. Sometimes we can start to implement telemedicine. That's one of our tricks that we're really starting to develop in Indiana, having a statewide medical system with 18 hospitals. We have an academic medical center, but we have lots of hospitals that are in the periphery of the state and in small communities and are really lacking some of those resources. So doing some of that telemedicine outreach is key. So assessment tools, when the Indiana emergency rule took effect, which was then replaced by the state law on how we manage patients on opioids in the state, I did a little lunch and learn session where I went around to each of the hospitals and met with the physicians and the providers in the hospitals and talked about this toolkit that we put together and embedded it within our electronic medical record. And that toolkit includes a SOAP and a COM and a GAD. PHQs are already part of the screening that we do for all of our patients coming in. It's a 2 that triggers a 9 if the 2 is positive. And then some of the other tools that can be utilized are the pain catastrophizing tools, the PEG, the opioid risk tool you can see is on the screen here. Steve, what tools do you use in your practice?
Well, it's interesting you said in the state of Washington, we actually have mandated rules from our new rules for acute and perioperative pain, subacute and chronic pain, that we need to use a functional outcome. So we use the PEG, which is pain, enjoyment of life, and general activity, across our whole system for any type of pain intervention or assessment. So they're still asking the pain question, which I think is important, but really focusing on enjoyment of life and general activity. And if you're going to use these tools, the key is really use them and have the patients understand it, because many times patients get kind of lazy and just check something off and don't really understand it. So use the tools and understand each patient's going to have a different understanding of how they use the PEG. But we've used the PEG, and that's been helpful. The opioid risk tool we also use for our assessment for patients for aberrant behaviors. And that's really just a good social history, trying to look at those risk factors, family risk factors, individual factors that may make them higher risk for aberrant behaviors. We see they're psychological or pre-adolescent sexual abuse, you know, significant feedback from patients. They've never been asked that before. And that we know that that type of trauma to the nervous system can predispose you to chronic pain as well as problems with opioids. So these tools are important. You need to use them and spend time. If you don't spend time with your patient just for a couple seconds, they're not going to think it's important too. So if you're going to use the tools, use them the right way, and it'll make your conversation with your patient a lot easier as well.
Yeah, the history of pre-adolescent sexual abuse increases the likelihood by fourfold.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, the idea of this your neuromatrix is sensitized. The nervous system has that effect, specific and separate from the memories and everything else psychologically that happened from that.
Right. You know, interestingly, as we move to this next slide, we have a question. Given the evidence of multidisciplinary approach to treating pain, how can we get insurance companies to cover it? And how do we ensure equal opportunities for the underserved patients with chronic pain and perhaps more risk factors due to the social determinants?
Yeah.
That's really one of the big challenges that we face regardless of where we're practicing. Interestingly, in the Indianapolis area, some of the best resources for people with addictions and chronic pain problems are located within the county hospital system. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, well, I have to comment for sure. I mean, in my background, so we run pain rehabilitation programs in our pain center with psychology, relaxation training, Tai Chi, and we have it open to Medicare and Medicaid, to all payer systems. And we're actually working on reaching out to different groups to get case rates and other coverage, because there's been a big problem with lack of coverage for those types of programs. If you look at the national, HHS Interagency Task Force, they actually recommended increased ways to incentivize better multidisciplinary treatment. Mm-hmm. So can they help primary care providers actually have a code for managing chronic pain, which takes a lot of time, which you don't get reimbursed or covered for, as well as increasing access to behavioral health interventions and actually increasing for team conferences and all those things you need to do to help manage those types mm-hmm. of patients. So there's been a push for that, but I think it's been slow. But you know, you as a clinician, you can still use those disciplines. And we'll talk about the different types of therapy here in a little bit you can use.
Right. And it comes back to advocacy at the patient level, at the hospital or system level, and ultimately at the state level. We have powerful voices in the positions that we hold. This next slide gets to what we've been alluding to, and that is there is no one-size-fits-all approach. There really has to be a close, collaborative approach, thinking about that biopsychosocial model that we discussed, and every patient is going to be different regardless of what their expectations are from when they walk in the office. It's really our job to help level set that before they leave. And many of these examples that we're seeing here are patients that likely have the type of chronic pain that's not necessarily debilitating and keeping them from doing the things that they want and need to do. But that's how chronic pain starts. People come in and they have a nagging issue that's limiting them in some way, whether it's keeping them from being able to rest comfortably or, you know, exercise or do any number of different things. When you look at the pain management toolbox, this is a very different conversation than we had 10 years ago. Looking at NSAIDs and over-the-counter medicines, thinking about yoga and Tai Chi, acupuncture, we've had a couple of questions that have come in about some of these alternative measures. One of the questions is around, are these things covered? Are insurance companies coming around? And what I've seen is there's not necessarily an insurance coverage for many of these, especially in the commercial plans, but most of our health savings accounts are becoming more favorable towards covering those types of services. So I would answer it depending on what type of plan people have, and actually the majority of the patients that we're taking care of within our system are on high deductible health plans that have that health savings account opportunity. Do you have a different experience?
Yeah, no, and I think the question came came up, you're right about acupuncture, and if you look at this patient at the bottom, it's the fourth patient, says, you know, for that type of patient, the gabapentinoids, Tai Chi, epidurals, maybe injections, maybe acupuncture. And on some of the recent guidelines, there is actually evidence for acute pain and for some chronic pain conditions for acupuncture. And we're seeing some of the payers actually starting to cover that, but I think it has to be done in the right manner. And how is that integrated with other types of treatments? We have an addiction specialist in our clinic that uses acupuncture for maintenance for his addiction patients. So, you know, you can use these things differently. I don't think it's going to be one size fits all for every patient, and that's what I think this slide represents, that every patient has different ideas, different beliefs, and what they actually want to do, and so you really need to tailor your treatment that way. Some patients, acupuncture may not be appropriate. They have other issues that need to be fixed first or assessed before doing that. So you really want to be careful, you know, where you place these different types of treatments.
That's why it's so important to ask those questions when they come in, so you have an idea of what their expectations are, because people many times have an idea.
Or they may just focus on one thing and understand that maybe take two or three things together that are really going to help them.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple of questions around opioids, and the next slide that I'll hand off to Steve is around the CDC guidelines.
Okay, yeah, and you're right, there were questions. I think one question came up, are opioids useful? And so I think what we're going to talk about is the CDC guidelines came out in March of 2016. Really, there were 12 recommendations for primary care for looking at new starts of opioids, as well as there was a significant mention on what to do with patients that are inherited. And with those patients on chronic opioids, you know, tapering them down to lower doses, you know, deciding who's appropriate and who's not. But if you look at the recommendations, I like to focus more on for new starts. It says that opioids are not the first line, and they should be actually integrated with other types of treatments. Discuss the risks, benefits of opioid therapy early on. I think the key about doing a trial of opioids, and is it appropriate, is it helping the patient versus starting a patient on an opioid and continuing that. The second set of recommendations focuses on selection, dosage, and duration of therapy, and it talks about, and this is where I think there was some confusion, use immediate-release opioids early. So when you're first starting a person on an opioid, you want them to be on a short-acting, not a long-acting. Then you can actually better manage any side effects or adverse effects. It says use caution at any dose. There is an increase in overdose and adverse effects at higher doses, but there's no significant cutoff point. So we like to think any dose is dangerous. And it says, use caution at any dose, reassess benefits at risk when the dose reaches greater than 50. And if you're going to go over 90, you need to justify that. These recommendations did not say you have to stop at 90 or all patients have to be on less than 90. It just really gives more caution in how we kind of titrate patients up. And so, you know, be careful going over 50, and if you're going to go over 90, you really need to justify that it's actually a benefit, or the benefits outweigh the potential risks or harms to the patient. Long-term use begins with treatment of acute pain, and so in different states this may vary. The CDC talked about 3 days or less is often sufficient. In our state, there's a 7-day limit for short acute pain. If you need to write over 7 days, you have to justify that in the medical record. And then we have a 14-day limit for perioperative pain. So you may start to see that in different states. Again, trying to minimize the amount of opioids that are out there. We have a lot of unused opioids that patients get that they never use, that go into medicine cabinets and end up unfortunately being misused by other people, and kind of getting into this kind of volume of medicines that are unused. So the CDC talked about more the dosing. It talked about the importance of a close follow-up and reevaluation. You know, many of our patients may be on opioids for a short time because of an acute pain condition. They don't need to continue that. And so how do you do a better assessment after 4 weeks or 6 weeks when maybe they don't need to stay on that medicine and taper that patient then versus waiting 1, 2, and 3 years later? And so really doing a better job in the short term in assessing patients and managing and assessing who's appropriate and who's not. And at the same time, doing a better job, like the last 4 or 5 recommendations, in assessing for risks and potential harms. And having a backup if a patient develops aberrant behaviors and addiction, being able to refer them for addiction treatment using buprenorphine, which Kevin's going to talk about, and other medicines for opioid use disorder. So the recommendations are 12 recommendations. I tell clinicians, if you're prescribing, be familiar with the guideline and understand also your state recommendations as well. So the guidelines came out. There was some controversy. I think a lot of states took these and did a good job at understanding a lot of these things we've been talking about for many years. Unfortunately, there was problems with kind of misinterpretation of the guideline. And different groups kind of pushed that with the CDC. And actually, the CDC came back in this spring of this year and actually published an article in JAMA kind of redefining some of those issues. And what happened was we saw plans kind of misapplying the guidelines and saying that all patients had to be on less than 90 with strict cutoffs. That was never the intention of the guideline. And so I really tell clinicians it's important to know what the guidelines are, know your own state rules, and understand the key is really looking at who's appropriate, who's not, how are you going to really individualize treatment. And then for those patients that are on chronic opioids, you know, figure out, is it appropriate for them to continue? Can you lower them to safer doses and still continue to manage them? But also, I think what's most important is integrating other types of treatment. Many of our patients were just on opioids. Were they getting treated for their depression or their anxiety? Other things that can really help them as well. Okay, so really not just putting all your eggs in one basket because there's really significant limitations as well as issues with addiction and harm with regards to opioids.
Yeah, there are so many patients that have come in to our practice over the last few years, and there are certain communities that have really been hit hard like this. I'm sure everyone's aware of the pill mill concept where people drive from miles and even states away to come get basically whatever prescription they wanted, and suddenly as there was a crackdown and those facilities started closing, there were huge communities of patients who were addicted to prescription medications and didn't have a practice, a place to go. Many of those end up in our offices coming in as new patients. And one of the descriptions that people use is it's dehumanizing to come in and be treated as a criminal because they're on this medicine. And in fact, they had been prescribed it by a physician or a practitioner. And at the end of the day, I think that is really one of those unintended consequences. As the pendulum has swung, people have just said, no, I'm not going to prescribe it, and no, I'm not going to accept patients into our practice. And that's really one of the challenges that I think we need to overcome. I think at least in the Midwest, we're making good progress. There isn't that constant effect of these practices getting shut down and a distribution of patients coming out. But I think we need to make sure that we're patient-centered as we approach this.
There's been a number of studies in the last couple of months that have been published with the effects of these non-consensual tapers where patients were being taken off and kind of abandoned and increase in, you know, overdose and even suicide. So really trying to figure out who's appropriate, who's not. And again, I really think trying to give them other techniques. Remember, opioids may help with analgesia, but they also have anxiolytic effects. There's also a lot of other effects of reward that patients are getting from the opioid. So you really need a good psychosocial assessment with that patient, separate from the patient that comes in with, you know, active opioid use disorder or substance abuse disorder.
Right.
I guess that's perfect timing. We were talking, this is for this slide, actually talking about education. So, you know, educating the public about safe storage of medicines, educating patients about what's their expectation about pain. You know, I don't think 5-10 years ago we were doing a lot about telling a patient, you're going to have surgery, this is what you should expect for 2 or 3 days after your surgery, right? How do we clarify that expectation? And also, you know, not just doing education with prescribers, but how do nurses talk to patients about pain, whether it's in the hospital? You know, all sorts of different things. Really, multiple stakeholders need to be involved in this from an education standpoint. And the last person we have there is policymakers, legislators, understanding many of these rules and laws may be in effect for opioid use disorder, but they're forgetting about chronic pain. So understand some of the pitfalls with some of the legislations that's out there, but understanding where does that really fit in? I don't know, Kevin, if you have any other comments about education.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate, much the way many patients have been made to feel like criminals. I mean, physicians many times have been painted in that, right, with that same stroke too. When lawmakers start saying the doctors caused this, you know, this is a medical community problem. Well, we do have to own it, but, you know, we were acting with good intentions and trying,
right,
to be patient-centered. We know now that that wasn't the right approach, and I think continuing to have that dialogue so that this isn't looked at as a health system problem and it's looked at as a public health problem is going to be key.
So correct. So we're actually going to move into talking about some of the new policies that are out there in a different approach to looking at opioids. So this is a good timing, Kevin. Mm-hmm. This is actually a study from Cochrane and some other reviews they put together looking at opioids versus non-opioid pain relief in post-operative pain. And what they showed was this is number needed to treat. So the number needed to treat a patient to get one patient to have 50% reduction in pain. And what they found was that actually ibuprofen and acetaminophen actually had a better number needed to treat than oxycodone alone. And so I think we can appreciate we have other medicines with other mechanisms of action, even used in combination, in many cases can have sometimes an even better effect, in this case, in the post-operative arena. If you look at post-operative prescribing, 1 in 16 surgical patients prescribed opioids become long-term users. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a reason why they're on opioids, but the other idea is many of those patients that were started on opioids probably could have been taken off after the first 6 to 12 weeks. And again, in our state of Washington, we now have subacute pain described where primary care providers have to assess patients during that time frame. But the key being really limiting the amount of exposure patients get and trying to prevent patients that need to continue on chronic opioids. This study actually from the University of Michigan looked at 190 patients undergoing 6 procedures. And what they did was just defined and actually gave patients choices to use non-opioids and then studied those patients 30 days and 60 days after their procedures. And they gave them kind of scheduled NSAIDs and acetaminophen. They gave them a very small amount of opioids. They didn't give them zero, but they gave them like 4 pills, and they gave them education about what they need to do. At the end of the study, 52% used no opioids after the procedure at all. Patients reported high levels of satisfaction with their pain control. When they looked at the actual number of opioids that were used, the median was like 2 pills. And you think about it, many of our patients are sent home after a surgical procedure, or you have family members, what happens? They get like 60 Percocet, right? And then they take how many, if any? 1 or 2, right? And so we have this huge unused amount of medicines that are out there. So groups like the University of Michigan and other groups around the country have really been doing a good job to get the word out there about prescribing a lot fewer pills and really assessing patients, as well as using and maybe avoiding opioids if you can, in the post-operative arena. And so, again, this is, I think, a good example of you can still have patient satisfaction if you do good multimodal treatment. We wanted to go through, this is from the Orthopedic Trauma Surgeons put together guidelines, and they put together guidelines for opioid and non-opioid therapy. They broke it down into major musculoskeletal injury, which would be a complicated fracture, an opioid reduction, internal fixation, so significant trauma. And then they broke down the second group, which I'll show you, which would be a simple fracture, and then developed guidelines for how to prescribe. And as you can see, this is a somewhat wordy, but I think it's a good overview. It looks at, in the inpatient arena, patients may get, for moderate pain, oxycodone, acetaminophen, that for severe pain, the same medicine, but at a higher dose. They may need hydromorphone IV, but at the same time, using non-opioid therapies. So on the right, you see ketorolac IV, gabapentin to decrease sensitization, and scheduled acetaminophen. And then with each week, they're actually on the left side decreasing the amount of opioids that are being prescribed as we increase on the right the non-opioid types of treatments. And so those include, again, NSAIDs, gabapentin, and going up to higher doses in gabapentin. So again, even with complex surgeries, having a plan how you're going to decrease the opioids over those ensuing weeks and at the same time increasing the non-opioid medications.
So, Steve, there was a specific question about that last slide. Just a clarification of what kind of surgery or injury were those patients having, and my understanding of the study was patients with long bone fractures that needed to have fixation, many of them open fixation and internal reduction.
Yeah, so that first group was definitely the more complex fractures. And again, those opioids are powerful analgesics, and patients need that type of pain control. And even in that case, they're actually able to show with these guidelines that you can actually do both. And I think that's the key, is the multimodal approach. There's the opioid pathway, there's also the anti-inflammatory pathway, acetaminophen scheduled. All of those together are going to have synergy versus just focusing on the opioid.
Yeah, it's interesting to see these guidelines, especially coming from the Orthopedic Trauma Association. In my sports medicine fellowship, and even before, it was really driven into our head that you never use anti-inflammatories in people with fractures because it can inhibit bone healing. And what's really recognized now is there's not evidence to support that. And in fact, obviously, there are other risks of using anti-inflammatory medicines, such as GI and renal dysfunction, but really getting back to considering that in your patients with fractures and not sticking to that avoid it at all costs, and a fracture automatically means opioids is not the standard anymore.
Right, and many patients may have side effects, they can't tolerate opioids at all. So,
right.
And again, it's important that the anti-inflammatory effect, and I think what I see a lot is, you know, like in this case, this is the recommendations for minor traumas. This is still minor, still surgical intervention, but using ibuprofen, but know what the therapeutic dose is, like really using the doses that they're gonna get serum levels that it's gonna help their pain. So in this case, they break it down on the left, and these are for minor surgical procedures. You may use hydrocodone for the short term, but also considering using tramadol for acute pain management. Tramadol is a weak opioid, but also affects serotonin and norepinephrine, and may have less a risk for misuse. And on the right side, again, using gabapentin, using ibuprofen, and on the right side, increasing those medicines from week 1 through week 4. And on the left side, with those minor surgeries, they say up to week 3. In this case, you're only giving a person 14 pills if needed. Mm-hmm. So again, decreasing the amount of opioids patients are getting, seeing them at shorter intervals, and following them more closely.
Yeah, Steve, there's a specific question around gabapentin and its addiction potential. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I know there's a lot of different medicines, and there's another question about duloxetine, but gabapentin decreases calcium modulation, so calcium into the cell. It's a gabapentinoid. It looks like GABA, which is an inhibitory neurochemical, but does not act like GABA. Gabapentin is FDA approved for postherpetic neuralgia. It's been used off-label to decrease sensitization. So many patients around surgery are given high doses of gabapentin, and pregabalin is a similar medicine to help decrease sensitization, and there's a thought that it may have an opioid sparing effect. But it's really FDA approved for postherpetic neuralgia. We're using it off-label. But even gabapentin, we see in our clinic, the clinical effect is probably at around 1,000 milligrams. The studies were really 3,000 milligrams. And so a lot of patients are on very low doses. So if you're gonna use it, you may have to go up to those higher doses. But it's working to decrease sensitization as a calcium modulator.
That's a great point for anti-inflammatories as well. So many times people who are using an anti-inflammatory for an acute injury or an acute problem never use enough,
right,
and you really have to use a prescription dose for it.
Have two or three in your toolbox, know what the anti-inflammatory effect, know what the analgesic effect is. Those can vary depending on it. And I have patients that maybe use their anti-inflammatories 3 or 4 days in a row and then hold for a couple of days to give their gut time to relax or to recover. So remember, anti-inflammatories can have significant problems, cardiac effects, renal effects as well. And this last slide kind of summarizes from the same group for non-operative. So these are patients that didn't have surgery. A third group, minor injury versus major injury. Again, really highlighting the use of tramadol, considering hydrocodone, acetaminophen, but also using those non-opioid medications. So I think this is, you know, not perfect. I think it's a good guideline, though, for clinicians. It really helps to kind of understand how to use opioids and non-opioids together with that population. So we'll turn this back over, and Kevin's going to go over education and the importance of that.
Yeah, and that's kind of been the key theme to many of the things I've been talking about today is, opioids, having them in your medicine cabinet isn't necessarily the safest place. I always try to educate patients that locking them in the glove box of their car isn't the most safe place either. It's amazing how many people come in with police reports saying that their car was broken into. I've got the proof, they took my medicine, I need an early refill. So that's really part of the key.
I thought that only happened in the state of Washington.
Indiana, there's a lot of smash and grab of prescription bottles, apparently.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, they just took your radio, for goodness sake. So there are medication take-back programs. Within Indiana, we actually provide all of this information to patients if they're part of our chronic opioid therapy program. It is part of the patient education materials that we give them. Disposal and household trash. I'm not sure people are going to dig through dirty cat litter to find medicines, but you never know. Certainly warn them about having personal information that's still on the prescription label. Deactivation pouches are available. And the FDA actually endorses flushing of medications, but there certainly can be an effect on the environment with that.
Yeah, dependent. That's a good point, because we get this question a lot about flushing, yeah. And especially when you say it in the state of Washington, people get all upset. But you know, you remember, where do patients on a day-to-day basis get rid of their opioids?
Right.
Well, their urine in the wastewater. And so the FDA actually says that you should flush unless you can get medicines to a take-back program.
Okay.
And then using... and there's actually FDA websites that tell you which meds are able to flush, because they feel that's a bigger risk than keeping the medicines that are unused in the medicine cabinet. And so that's a big change. So know those different things. And in our state, we have to give patients information about safe storage and disposal. Just asking your patient, where do you store your meds? You'd be surprised where patients store their meds, right,
yeah.
Kevin? And you know, they'll tell you these crazy places, and then that's a good opportunity for you to say that's not appropriate and explain. You know, I had one patient that told me she keeps her meds under her bed next to her gun. And I said, well, is your gun locked up? She said, no. I said, well, maybe you should have both of those. So, but it was an interesting discussion, you know, but that's what she's been doing. So again, I think that's important. And I document in the chart, we had that discussion.
It comes back to that dialogue.
And nothing against guns, but you know, so.
Yeah. So, like I said, getting people to the point that they recognize coming in what reasonable goals are. A 30% reduction in pain is typically enough to cross that threshold for people to be able to have a more meaningful and functional life. So setting that in advance, trying to steer clear of the expectation that especially chronic pain is ever going to go away completely, thinking about ways to incorporate cognitive behavioral therapy. There are CBT apps that people can use, that they can put on their phone, many different ways, and it really depends on the personality of the patient, the beliefs that they have, some of the resources that they might have, but looking at the patient owning this, taking an active role, and trying to think about treatment outside of just medications. So if anyone was concerned that Dr. Stannis was the only one that would get to play with the augmented reality, I do get a chance to do it here myself. I'm just going to forward to the next slide, which kind of highlights some of the information here. So as we take a look at the human brain, we're familiar with the concept of the gyrification and the fact that there are gyri. One of the big things that we really worry about is people being exposed to certain types of chemicals, certain types of medicines, illicit drugs, before their brain is mature and the effect that might have on their brain. We know that this gyrification does not mature in girls until about age 21. And if you ask my wife, it probably never matures in men, but science would suggest that it's about age 27. And some of the inhibitory pathways for these medications and the effect on our neurologic system don't mature until well after adolescence. So you can kind of imagine how that early exposure and that early effect on a developing brain can cause problems. So as we take a look at the slide here, we identify the nucleus accumbens. As family physicians, I'm quite confident that none of us have thought about the nucleus accumbens for many years, but that is the dopamine-rich area of the brain that mu receptor opioids affect. And when that effect takes place, we start to see And it's demonstrated well on the slide to the side, where that effect then takes place, goes through the mesial and then cortical and then up to the frontal cortex. And that's what drives this continued behavior of use and abuse of this type of agent. When we look at to the next slide, we think about the idea of the consumption of opioids to achieve that high, that increased exposure to drug cues, and then the trigger to continue to consume, even though people in their brain, in their consciousness, recognize that this is something that's going to do them harm and will continue to cause problems. People can't overcome that. They don't necessarily make the rational decision to break that cycle. So we see this cycle continue to go, and at the end of the day, it's part of what people are predisposed to. We all know patients that take opioids and like me, either become sick and would prefer to die than take it. Others, the first time they take it or in a very short period of time, they get that positive reinforcement, and you can kind of see that cycle turning, which is why those screening tools are so effective in thinking about who's really at risk when we look at that. So mitigating the adverse consequences of the opioid crisis, somewhere between 2 and 6 million people we think have opioid use disorder. You know, whether how accurate that is, and I personally would venture to say that that's an understatement based on what we're seeing in society and overdose deaths. And at the very most, 20 to 40% of them are actually in opioid use disorder treatment programs. We need to continue to look at the policies that expand access to and delivery of evidence-based treatment. It's really critical to reducing the risk of opioid overdose and the mortality that goes along with that.
Kevin, it says that the 20 to 40% of persons with opioid disorder receive treatment. That's MAT therapy. A far lower percent, a greater percentage actually are not getting any behavioral health. And so, you know, treating this just with medications is not the answer. And we're seeing that we really need increased access to these other treatments as well with treatment of opioid use disorder, including cognitive behavioral therapy and things like that.
Yeah. The reference listed on this slide, half a G, if you take a look at that article, it's an interesting look at counties and communities that are more at risk or less at risk for having a higher rate of opioid abuse. And when you look at some of the factors that led to higher rates of abuse, it really came down to what the penetration of primary care was. If there was a higher primary care physician presence per capita, the rate was lower. If there was a 1% increase in unemployment relative to the national average, there was a higher rate. So you really start to see some of these societal effects taking place. We've had a few questions about methadone and buprenorphine, a couple about naltrexone as well. It's been fantastic. We've had so many people engaged in this in the talk and asking questions that we can barely read them as fast as they're coming up, but very relevant questions, and certainly the reason that we're providing this information. So when we think about methadone, we think of a full mu opioid agonist. It is available, has been available through methadone clinics for many years. There are individual and independent providers that prescribe methadone as well. Buprenorphine is a more recent addition to our medical management regimen, and it's a partial mu opioid agonist, either alone or in combination with naloxone. And then we have naltrexone. We had a specific question about naltrexone for in this setting. And certainly naltrexone is something that is incorporated into many addiction programs. When we think about starting people on naltrexone, they have to be abstinent for about 7 to 10 days before they start. That's certainly going to trigger a withdrawal effect if you start within that time frame. Steve, do you want to add anything to this?
There was actually a question here I think that's important. I don't want to get you off track too much, that it said the majority of the opioid crisis is heroin, fentanyl, crystal meth, and cocaine. In general, no physicians prescribe this, so why blame physicians? So I think that's important. I don't think we were blaming physicians at all, and there's definitely a problem with illicit substances and overdose deaths. The good thing is, I think for the first time in 30 years, even the overdose deaths, which can be a lot of things, illicit substances as well as prescription opioids, went down for the first time by 5%. So there are things we're doing a better job for. But I do think it's important, you know, that prescribing is going down. There's 50% lower, a 50% reduction in patients on high-dose opioids. So we're seeing prescribing going down. That doesn't mean it still can't be a problem. So I don't want to say at all that physicians should be blamed for all of the overdose deaths. We know where we as prescribers have to do a better job of preventing over-prescribing or unnecessary medicines that are out there. And then on, like what you're talking about, understanding how to assess patients and treat patients with opioid use disorder that need it.
Right. And ultimately, that was the reasoning behind the statement I made earlier, is much the same way that patients on opioid therapy, especially high-dose therapy, were vilified. Physicians were vilified in this as well. So that is certainly not the message. This slide from that same article I referenced earlier from JAMA earlier this year, the red highlighted counties across the country are the counties that do not have medication opioid use disorder provider in that county. That's waivered and noted through the data bank. When you look across the middle of the country, there's a huge swath of red there. And in fact, 71% of rural counties lacked a publicly available OUD medicine provider in 2017. So I think this really stresses an opportunity that we have. Certainly many of the family medicine residencies around the country, including in Indiana, are either signing up or assisting with getting their residents signed up to be waivered, to be providers. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that there's this one extra hoop to jump through to be waivered to provide Suboxone therapy when, in fact, people don't need to jump through that additional hoop to prescribe many of the medicines that have at least helped precipitate this national epidemic. So getting to Narcan, obviously it's not a cure. It is something to include in our treatment programs and our conversations. It's one of the top five strategies from SAMHSA to prevent overdose deaths. At this point, all 50 states and the District of Columbia have legislation include increasing access where pharmacists can distribute these directly without prescriptions. And we need to take down even more barriers. We know while it's making a difference, the penetration isn't what it needs to be to ultimately get us to the point that people have that life-saving tool at least available when they need it. And back to the good news. As I mentioned earlier, the overdose deaths went down from 2017 to 2018, and the number of Narcan prescriptions dispensed doubled during that time. But for every 70 prescriptions of high-dose opioids that are prescribed, there's only one Narcan prescription dispensed. So there's still not quite that connection that we need to see. Rural counties are three times more likely to be low-dispensing counties, and naloxone dispensing is 25 times greater in the highest-dispensing counties. So you kind of see that mismatch there. and going back to that previous slide, we many of those counties represented in red don't have access to medication therapy. I'm looking at Narcan. There are three different approved formulations: the injectable, the auto-injectable, and then the prepackaged nasal spray. The piece of the nasal spray, it has to be sprayed into a nostril while the patient is lying on their back. It's very important for people to get that information about utilizing it in advance of them needing to use it for someone. Certainly those educational materials, the administration instructions are available through the SAMHSA website, and we really try to connect patients to that information as we educate them along the way.
And I would just comment on the naloxone. I mean, it's one tool. I think it's important not to just focus on the morphine equivalent in our state if you're high risk, because a patient could be on 20 morphine equivalents, but go home and overdose their whole month's supply, right? And so that morphine equivalent characterization a lot of time doesn't reflect really their true risk. But we also look at what are the other risk factors for overdose and respiratory depression. So that would be pulmonary issues, cardiac problems. And so we assess that in patients as well. So you may have a patient on low doses, but has scoliosis, they have poor respiratory reserve, they have COPD and sleep apnea. That person's at a lot higher risk, separate from whatever their morphine equivalent is, or if they have an infection,
they're drinking alcohol
and other things. Mm-hmm. So, really looking at the naloxone individually, and because you'd probably have a lot more high-risk patients on lower doses, and again, they get sick, and their risk really changes. So really look at naloxone as one tool, but individually looking at each patient.
What's the highest morphine equivalent dose you've ever seen a patient on?
We had patients in the 6,000 morphine equivalents, but that was a long time ago. We're not seeing those doses as much, but yep. And I think it's important too. The VA came out with a really good study with overdoses, and it really had nothing to do with 90 morphine equivalents. 70-80% of those overdoses were in patients on less than 50. And the risk factors were psychiatric problems and other issues. So I think it's important to look at the morphine equivalent, but really look at these other factors when you're looking at risk for overdose.
Yeah, the morphine equivalent is really an inflection point of where the percentage risk goes up, but there's a small percentage that are on that dose relative to lower doses.
And I'm glad you brought up, because we didn't talk about benzodiazepines. A lot of that too is concomitant use of benzodiazepines, and those patients by far have a higher risk of overdose. And so a lot of states are doing a lot more to really limit benzodiazepine use that's not necessary. And the CDC guideline also discusses that as well. We didn't have it in the slide deck here, but you're limiting benzodiazepines. Many patients are on sleepers for many years. They don't need their alprazolam, but it can put them at higher risk. So really trying to limit starting patients, and if patients come in on benzodiazepines, reassessing if they really need to continue that.
Yeah, and wean them off.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're stuck here. If you could just move the slide forward to the last slide here.
There we go. So, we talked about risk assessment tools. I think, we went over assessing nociceptive, neuropathic, nociplastic pain, and try to start thinking about the different mechanisms that are involved in why a person presents with pain, whether it's going to be how you approach pharmacologically or even the non-pharmacologic approaches. We talked about educating patients about pain, whether it's safe storage of their medicines, what are their expectations, setting realistic goals with patients as well. And again, kind of looking at this in a more patient-centered fashion. Kevin, you want to go over the last couple?
Yeah, so we think about the opportunity to provide medication assistance for OUD. We also realize that it's that extra hoop to jump through, but it really is meaningful, especially if there's no one else in your community that is providing that service. And it's not the magic bullet, but it is a piece of it. We have to know all of the resources that are available within our medical neighborhood. And lastly, don't forget about Narcan. Even if writing scripts for it, even though patients may already be aware, they they may already have one, you know, it never hurts to continue to remind them that this is a tool to have.
And having Narcan in the house, we had a patient that was really a low risk, but when I told her about naloxone, she said, you know, I have a family member that's been struggling with opioid problems and addiction problems. We probably should have it in our house. And so
Absolutely.
Again, it's, you know, a lot of states in our state now, you can go to any pharmacy and get a naloxone script without a prescription from a physician. Mm-hmm. So again, getting that out in the community is going to be important.
Okay.
So we have some questions.
We have a lot of questions.
And the one I didn't get to, and I think Kevin asked me about it, was is there an addictive potential of gabapentin? There was an increased signal in the prison population study with gabapentin misuse. Gabapentin at higher doses has an anxiolytic effect like pregabalin, and so there may be likability in that. I'm not aware of any studies showing an addiction potential, but it may be used recreationally. There is a thought that in the prisons, gabapentin may be used, and in other cases, gabapentin's used to mitigate withdrawal. And so there has been this blip with gabapentin, but we're not sure what it really means with it being misused or some kind of likability.
Yeah, one of the questions here is, do people on the street ever accuse one of assault of the person giving the Narcan? And part of, I think the last bullet on the slide referenced Good Samaritan laws, and 46 states have Good Samaritan laws related to if you're giving Narcan in for good reason, in good conscience, you're protected from being charged and accused.
Mm-hmm. We have another question here. How do you prescribe opioid medications for patients that need it but prevent drug seekers from coming to established care? I mean, that's a great question. You know, that's the kind of the art of medicine, unfortunately. You know, doing a good assessment, doing a good physical exam, and does what they're telling you fit with the physical exam? I like to have patients walk me through a day. What time do you take your medicine? You know, what time do you get up in the morning? What time do you take your medicine? What's your activity between 8 and 12? I kind of have them walk through the day. If they're taking their medicine, how long does it give you some relief? You know, get a good idea of individually from that patient how they're using their medicine. A person that's diverting, or a person that, you know, may have other reasons why they want medicines from you, are going to really struggle with that. So, you know, really get a good sense from the patient, and I think that's going to make you feel better when you're making that decision. Are opioids or treatment effective or appropriate? I think, too, be careful of the patient that comes in and everything else has failed. The only thing they want is their opioid. I mean, that's where you have to be thinking, is there opioid use disorder? Is there something else they're getting out of the medicine? Or are they diverting? You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of diversion that still is happening out there, and we as clinicians just need to be aware of that and, again, doing a better assessment.
To add on to that, there was a question I saw earlier with regards to having patients do drug screens, and how does that make them feel? We were talking about the making patients feel like criminals for, and unfortunately, and maybe fortunately, it is actually part of the requirements in many states that you do screen people at least annually to ensure that the right medicines are there and other things are not there. So it is a fine line between helping people understand that this is part of the requirements and treatment recommendations as opposed to some kind of punishment or lack of trust.
Yeah, and in our clinic, all new patients, we do a point of care urine test. In our state, based on how you're risk stratified, the rules state that you need to do urine screening at least, you know, for the higher risk patients once a quarter versus once a year for the lower risk patients. If there's aberrant behaviors, urine screens can be very helpful. So we explain it to patients. This is part of our management. We do this with all of our patients, and so patients understand that. That being said, we didn't have time to go through urine screens. You know, understand the limitations of what a point of care test can show you, and use confirmatory testing as well, because you may get false positives and false negatives if you're going to use urine testing. Again, have a good idea about that. There are different guidelines out there that can help you kind of walk through that. But urine samples can be really good, especially with new patients. You're getting a new patient into your practice. That's part of your assessment with those new patients.
Yeah, and just a comment from one of the audience members. Several of my patients have come back asking for more Narcan after using on another family member or friend, and that really highlights that point of it needs to be available so that when this occurs, someone knows what to do and has the toolkit to do it.
Okay. So how do you distinguish increased pain complaint as pain versus tolerance to opioids? So I think that one we can spend a long time on. So tolerance is the need to get the same effect. Dependence is if you stop the medicine abruptly, patients will go through withdrawal or have those withdrawal-like symptoms. It's very difficult. I think the old thinking was is when you started a person on opioids, as they were on it, tolerance would go on forever. What we're seeing is most patients have tolerance for the first couple of months, and so we're using a lot lower doses and not escalating doses on patients. But again, that whole pain response or what they're telling you, you also, I think, need to be doing assessments for anxiety, depression, because of all of those things, if those things are elevated, that may be the main reason why their pain complaint is still a 10 out of 10. And so again, I think not just focusing on the pain scale, but doing those other questions and taking a better history may make that clear. Again, the visual analog scale, the verbal rating scale is only as good as how you use it. And then in some patients, I actually don't ask them about their pain score because it's always a 10. They just can't understand that. And so I really focus on what are their functional changes. I always think it's good to identify what are two or three things you're struggling to do now that you feel if I can help your pain, you'll be able to do better. And we just focus on those two or three goals. Mm-hmm. And when they come back, that's what we assess.
And that's exactly why the visual analog scale wasn't part of that toolkit that we talked about, because it focuses the patient solely on their pain perception as opposed to the function and all of those other pieces.
And in some cases, it may be very helpful, just know individually patients have a different response and a different understanding. There was a question about duloxetine and how that would help with pain. Again, we didn't have time to go through all the different medicines, but duloxetine is a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. It's FDA approved for depression and anxiety, but also for certain neuropathic pain conditions. It's also approved for axial low back pain and knee pain. So it's interesting, you have a medicine that's really approved for nociceptive neuropathic and nociplastic pain. And that probably just underscores with a lot of these chronic pain conditions, increasing serotonin and norepinephrine, which in the nervous system inhibits pain signals, can help patients. And so duloxetine is, again, an antidepressant, but we're also using it for other pain conditions. And you also may get an antidepressant effect that helps with their pain, too, which is somewhat difficult to distinguish sometimes.
There's a question about over-the-counter or prescription anti-inflammatory medicines, and I don't think there's really a one-size-fits-all answer here. Most of the time when I'm managing a patient, I'll ask them what they have in the home. I'll educate them what that prescription dose equivalent is. If they report that they haven't had a good effect from taking the Aleve or the ibuprofen, we'll consider something else. If they're not tolerating it with some stomach upset, we'll consider adding a short-term PPI or even one of the COX-2 inhibitors. So, but I usually have people start with over-the-counter formulations, which are going to be much easier. The caveat to that is many people have health savings accounts, so if they get a prescription for it, they can pay for it out of that account, and they're very focused on being able to spend that money. So that's kind of the approach I take.
So we have 1 minute. There was a question here. We knew this was going to come up. We should have bet on this, Kevin. Where does CBD and THC fit into pain management? We have our own endogenous cannabinoid system. There is evidence that cannabinoids can actually inhibit pain signals and actually have anti-inflammatory effects. Kind of a quick answer, though, as a prescriber, you have a DEA license, which is federal. Cannabis, cannabinoid, CBD is all still scheduled one under the DEA, so it would still be considered an illicit substance. So we still do not prescribe opioids if patients are using, or we have a plan for them to stop using cannabinoids. But again, I'm not saying there isn't evidence. That evidence is evolving. But I think, from a practical standpoint, your license, you're still prescribing under your DEA, which is still scheduled one. That may change, but for now, it's still scheduled one. So that's how we explain it to our patients. And then the other thing is, if patients are using cannabinoids, and we see this a lot with our patients, do they have a cannabinoid use disorder? And so just like understanding opioid use disorder, be familiar with cannabinoid use as we see more of that being used recreationally.
Especially when you're having those conversations with your young patients, those adolescent patients, and really trying to dig down on if they're using cannabis. Most of the time, it's not going to be for pain, but once again, in that developing brain, as we talked about earlier, it can have a profound effect.
Okay, so that last question about cannabinoids was not done on purpose, because if you can see up on the screen, CME Outfitters is actually putting on a CBD conference 2020 in February 26th to 27th of next year. There's also a master class for neuroscience professional development that's going to be offered. So that's just a CME announcement. We want to thank you guys. There's a ton of great questions here. We're only able to get through a few. We hope we're able to kind of cover this kind of wide issue around opioid prescribing, opioid overdose, and the problems with opioid addiction. And again, we thank you for your time. We thank the people that were listening in the country, in the U.S. and around the world that were live streaming this. You had information on how you can take the slides and the content. We're going to stay around for a couple minutes to answer questions, but we want to thank you. I want to thank Kevin. It was really good having you, helping us out to get through this. But again, have a great meeting, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you.